We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. All over the world, sports fans root for the home team, but at the same time, professional sports have truly become a global force. There are some sports franchises that have become popular internationally, and certainly there are individual athletes who have become international celebrities. In fact, as our guests for this hour argue, sports and athletes have become agents of globalization. We'll explore this morning the interaction of the global and the local in sports as we talk with two guests from the University of Michigan. Andre Markowitz, he is professor of comparative politics and German studies, and also Lars Rensman, he's professor, assistant professor of political science. And the two of them together have authored a book that's titled Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. As we talk, questions are welcome. We hope people will keep it to a question, keep it brief, and keep it on the topic, but other than that, calls are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you may also send emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, your questions are welcome. Professor Markowitz, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Good. And Lars Rensman, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for having us.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. I think that this is just we talk so much about globalization these days, and particularly looking at economic issues. And, you know, it's undeniable, I suppose, that the entertainment industry is global, and that's a force of globalization. And so I suppose you really shouldn't be surprised that as sports, I think you can look at that as an adjunct of the entertainment industry, I think. Maybe no big surprise that it would have some of the same features, or at least some of the same sorts of issues and questions and interesting things would be happening with globalization with sport as with these other things.
Yes, although I'd like to object a little bit about classifying sports as sort of an adjunct or an appendage to the entertainment industry. Sports have, of course, always had an entertainment component to them, all the way back to the ancient Greeks. But they're a bit different. I mean, there is an element to them which we argue makes them actually quite unique by virtue of their competitive nature, and above all by virtue of their unscriptedness. Mm. I think that's crucial. The difference between an opera or a movie or any other form of entertainment is that we know or the ending, or the ending is not the issue. That is not the case, of course, with sports. The minute we know the ending in sports, it's, of course, not sports. We see it as fraud. Anyway, but the point, of course, in our book is that sports in the era of what we call the second globalization, commencing sort of in the 1970s and onward to today, have attained a dimension of internationalization that is congruent to what happened in the era of what we call the first globalization, namely between 1860 and 1900, roughly, but that it really has become exponential, and in which you really see global entities that are, in fact, that are really timeless and really spaceless. In other words, you can follow them anywhere you can become their fans anywhere at any time. Mm-hmm. And that that we argue is quite unique.
Yeah. Well, as they say in court, then I will withdraw my remarks. I guess I didn't. I think I sort of expressed that badly. I don't know that I really meant so much that it was an offshoot of entertainment as it. Well, maybe the thing to say is that it has some of the same features, but as you say, certainly aspects of sport are unique, and I suppose also there can be a quality of nationalism involved that probably you don't attach to other sorts of things.
David, yeah, that's where I would like to add something, and that is identities play a huge role.
Right,
and
yeah,
that's also something that we argue in our book. It's not just about these, you know, global icons that you find in popular culture, like a Denzel Washington, who certainly has, you know, a lot of impact in terms of the acceptance of diversity and creating world-known American, in this case African-American stars. There's a different dimension to it, and that is this interaction between the global and the local, and that is that identities are, of course, very much shaped by sports, and sports are crucial in our local and our national identities.
Mm-hmm.
And considering that, this is something that we explore in our book. How does that interact? How is the interplay between the rise of those global icons, like Kobe Bryant, who is now arguably the most popular man in China, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the persistence of our local ties that very much are facilitated through sports.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, something that's really interesting, and that is that while on the one hand, people here in the United States, they root for the Lakers or the Bulls, or people in Britain root for Manchester United, or in Italy, they root for AC Milan, that in fact, all over the world, there are people who root for those teams who are not British, Italian, or American, so that they have attained a kind of a status. People in the where they are still attached to them, but so are people all over the world.
Right, but what is interesting is that if you look at all these teams, you say the Lakers. Yes, they're of course a global team. They're loved in LA. Trust me, they're hated in Boston. or actually everywhere else in the United States. And in fact, Beat LA has become an absolute mantra that is part of the American sports vernacular. The other day I saw this guy on ESPN who came on with a jersey, Beat LA, touting something. I forget now what it was. So what is interesting is that these, and the same, by the way, for all these other teams, that Man U, trust me, is probably the most hated anything in Liverpool, just a couple of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're trying to argue in the book is that these earlier, that these local identities have in fact not abated. See, I think much of the globalization literature seems to, and this is nothing to do with sports, seems to argue that somehow globalization, which, by the way, very often means Americanization,
mm-hmm.
Wrongly, by the way, but simplistically, basically sees a kind of loss of the local, a kind of sort of steamrolling by the global, which in fact destroys all our local mores and accents and whatever. And in fact, we're arguing that this is not the case, that being a Man U fan or a Lakers fan or whatever teams you pick, Milan fan, yes, they are global entities, but they still, of course, remain very much part of that culture that spawned them 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, you think about the first wave of globalization that you mentioned, which was the moving of out from Britain, the moving of soccer, and perhaps I'm sure maybe slightly to a lesser extent rugby and cricket, and then in the United States we have moving out from the United States, primarily football, American football, basketball, baseball, and again maybe to a somewhat less extent hockey. Although here in the United States, depending on where you live, hockey could either be very big or or people don't pay any attention to it at all.
Right.
So that first wave really was from the English, the big English-speaking empires
right.
out, and I don't know if there's really been anything else like that. Maybe there has, but there does seem to be that kind of dominance of Britain and the U.S.
Yes, but emanating from the first globalization.
Yes.
But the second globalization already transforms that. Of course, you cannot understand what's happening today without understanding what happened, again, between 1860 and 19, or in the 19th century, let's say. Mm-hmm. However, it's not what really happens is that in the second globalization, there are now spaces in each of these respective cultures that are starting to really fray and also have the other enter it to some degree. So, for example, soccer in the United States and basketball and the American sports in Europe, and all of them actually in a mishmash across the entire world. So, with China being a great example, but not only China, Japan, others as well. And I think that's what's such an exciting thing in terms of how sports really, and especially when we talk about sports, we really mean very few sports. We are actually not interested in the producers of sports. Our book is mainly about their consumers or the sports fans or what people follow, what people hope for, dream of, worry about. So basically a couple of team-oriented or team-dominated games with ball-like contraption. Mm. That's what really this is all about.
And I don't know, Professor Markovich, you can add on to that in any way you like. I'm just, though, continuing to think about the first wave of globalization and how that worked. And was that really about imperialism? Or was that just kind of the games just went along?
I mean, clearly, imperialism, absolutely, in the sense that if you look at who the dominant player, actually, or players, if we count the United States, although in a different way because it was much more sort of self-contained, clearly it was due to Britain's economic and political might that the sports languages spread, no question. But that's what's so interesting. Is it kind of a form of imposition, a form of sort of direct control? No, not at all. I think the best example of this, we cite this in, there's a great book by a West Indian Marxist named C.L.R. James, who shows how the game of cricket, arguably one of the most sort of stylized, sort of aristocratic or quasi-aristocratic British or English, to be even more precise, English sports spreads to the West Indies and there becomes part of one of the most beloved form of culture and pastime for all West Indian males. Mm-hmm. So is it imperialism? Yes. Obviously, it wasn't some game, in a local game played in South America that was adopted in Manchester, but rather the other way around. So clearly it's Euro-centered, but it's not an imperialism that is common associated with sort of repression.
Yeah, what is interesting to note in that is also, I want to add to this, that clearly early on, when this game was played, let's say soccer in South Africa, when there were games between the white teams and the black teams, this was certainly also very soon a source of pride, a source even of resistance. And that has been shown also in our book, but also at other places, that early on these encounters become much more complex than just simply this one-way street. And that's very similar when we talk about second globalization in many ways. It's not just a one-way street. Certainly, most of these games, the major games, where the best of the best play, do take place in America and in Europe. But it's not a one-way street. It's there are multiple interactions, so to speak, and one of these, you know, the impacts that we have today, particularly the second globalization, Professor Markovitz already mentioned that, is the Chinese example. Of course, that is, I find, almost most striking, where you have an entire nation playing basketball when 30 years ago no one played basketball there.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
there are still effects that take place and changes with all the persistence and resilience that we find in hegemonic sports cultures across the world once they were established in first globalization.
Let me
just say this very briefly. The core, clearly there, we talk about core, semi-periphery, periphery. Clearly cores exist, but peripheries are not powerless, to put it bluntly.
Let me introduce again our guests for this hour, Lars Rensman and Andre Markovitz. Andre Markovitz is a professor of comparative politics and German studies at University of Michigan. Lars Rensman is assistant professor of political science at the University of Michigan. They are the co-authors of the book Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. Princeton University Press, the publisher. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else that you certainly deal with in the book that is another way that globalization works is, on the one hand, we have seen these sports that essentially developed in England and in the U.S. become international, and how athletes, we have Kobe Bryant, we have David Beckham, people like that certainly have become international celebrities, and also, and particularly in soccer, there are European players who are, and there are South American players who are. And in as much as people still have this real identification with the home team, what's really interesting is that there seems to be quite a high level of acceptance of foreign players. That is to say, you know, if you're in the United States, you got no problem rooting for Yao Ming. Or if you're in Europe, for the most part, European fans will have no problem for rooting for players that come from outside of Europe, and that's very interesting too.
Well, again, let me qualify that some. Sure,
sure.
That is the case, what we call with the best of the best, and as long as they're winning. if they are not winning, and by the way, we devote an entire chapter to what we call the counter-cosmopolitan dimensions of all this. That, in fact, players are not were not welcome. The first black players were anything but welcome. And in, as we argue in our chapter, that in lower leagues, and actually not only lower leagues, I mean, we talk about why this is more pronounced in Europe, and we can maybe talk about that later in, if you have questions about that. But that, in fact, yes, you're quite right. It is accepted. In fact, they you know, no... you know, I've been a huge Yankees fan since 1960, when I arrived as a child in the United States, and I remain a Yankees fan regardless of who is in the lineup. In other words, whether they are Dominicans or Japanese or South Koreans or guys from Kansas or, you know, even the Bronx, of which there are very few. So the point is that these teams... And from the very get-go, actually, we argue, from 1869, when the Cincinnati Red Stockings become the first professional team, meaning for the first time in the world you have grown men being paid for performing actually a child's game, more or less, that you have the professionalization. Actually, only one of these guys is from Cincinnati. What we're saying then is that the inherent nature of the competitive nature of sports, because it is based around winning, is indeed, we argue, immensely meritocratic, hence actually emancipatory and progressive. So yes, you're right that actually even a racist in Houston, your example, or someone who otherwise does not like the Chinese, completely overcomes this sentiment because Yao Ming is a great player and he plays for the Rockets and he beats up on the Lakers. Great. But, again, the but is that this is not something that is smooth sailing. We give lots of examples how, for instance, the great French player Thierry Henry, who now plays for the Red Bulls in New York, was berated and demeaned by the Spanish national coach simply for being black. Yes, these things are wonderfully emancipating and actually act out well, but only up to a point. And again, I think what our book does, if I can be so shamelessly self-promoting, is that it shows the complexity of this.
Mm-hmm.
That, yes, it's true what you said, but on the other hand, there are still what we call counter-cosmopolitan trends, that in fact black players are still berated. Let's not even talk about the homophobia that exists in all these sports, which is completely accepted. I do not know of any person, any player who, while playing in any of these hegemonic sports, has come out and admitted to being gay.
Hmm. Well, and it also seems to be the case, though, that again, to show the complexity here, is that the tolerance for outsiders, as you say, for the bigger clubs, particularly if the team is doing well, the tolerance is higher. But when you get to clubs that truly are the local club, the home team, that the tolerance for outsiders is much, much less.
Yeah, I would qualify this a little bit. Look, for someone in Nebraska, wherever in Nebraska, with no pro team, the University of Nebraska football team is arguably the team the a kid growing up looks to and roots for. So in a way, this is, of course, then a local team. It's this, certainly the problems get bigger on the lower levels. But again, I would say, and we argue in this book, that even with all these problems and struggles, and of course sports reflect what's going on in the rest of society. If you have racism in the rest of society, it will also reflect in sports. But you do have a similar level of diversity that you can find in sports when it comes to professional sports. On the level of professional sports, it is very meritocratic, and it is more diverse than any other space in society. When we talk about global corporations, they're still very much ruled by a certain, they're very nationalistic in many ways. Or look at any other sphere of society, and that's something that is striking about sports. It is very diverse, and so to some extent, with all these struggles, it's never easy to create acceptance of diversity, of foreign players, of foreigners. But we do think that sports can play and does play a big role in that, creating and generating acceptance of others, of foreigners. Not of gays, yeah. That's for sure.
And just one more thing. We're getting some calls lined up here, so we'll get to talk with some people who are listening. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm engaging in boosterism for the United States, but it does seem to be the case that some of the problems that we see in Europe, hooliganism and violence by fans, some of the kinds of racism and anti-Semitism that you see, particularly in European soccer, you know, I don't want to make it sound like there's no racism in the United States.
But don't be so, I know your NPR station. De rigueur not to say anything laudatory about the United States, but in this case you can, yes.
It seems that the kind of problems that you see in Europe, we don't see them in the United States.
Absolutely. We did see them certainly in the 50s and 60s. Just read any book about how the travails of Jackie Robinson and the early African American players in a formerly segregated baseball. So it's not that we don't have racism, and it's not that American sports don't have experienced racism. But what we're arguing is that society as a whole has made race, and again, not homophobia and other forms of discrimination, but have made race really a form of racism. Excuse me, racism, an unacceptable form of a pejorative or of jeering. Having lived in the United States most of my life, I've gone to thousands of American sporting events, literally, in all big of the big four. I have not encountered ever any kind of racist taunts, which is absolutely de rigueur in Europe. Why this is the case, we can maybe, elaborate further, but I think you're quite right. We argue very emphatically that this is a enlightened in the American public discourse. Mm. You actually can be can be a booster for the United States.
All right, we're number one. Let's get some callers here, and also very quickly here, we're in our midpoint. I want to reintroduce our guests, Andrei Markovits. He is a professor of comparative politics and German studies at University of Michigan. Lars Rensman is assistant professor of political science at University of Michigan. They are the co-authors of the book Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. We have some callers here. Let's get right to that, and we will start with someone in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
That is to say good morning, I guess. I find the discussion actually very interesting, and particularly the book, or I guess the discussion of the book or introduction of the book, about revealing the complexities, I guess, of the globalizing, I guess, tendencies of sports. I wanted to ask, I find the title very fascinating, Gaming the World, and I suspect that it's more than just a very catchy title, which it certainly is. There's, of course, something sinister, I guess, to the phrase gaming the system. I'm wondering what maybe that sinister aspect is, if it is indeed sinister.
No sinister. both Lars and I are very, it was more of a, are aware of the potentially sinister thing of taking someone for a ride or but actually, no. We did not imply anything sinister here at all.
Okay.
All right. That gets at the question then.
It certainly does get at the question. I think it's certainly an interesting title. I guess that it certainly prompts one to read the book, if only to find that really it is not. Sinister in your estimation at all.
No. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Please, by all means, it would be lovely for you to read the book, and let's be in touch.
Right. Well, we'll go to another caller here, Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm a little diverted by this offhand remark about NPR always having to be critical of the U.S. I would think that people can perceive that the criticism is well circumscribed by what's called the limits of allowable debate by like media analysts like Chomsky, et cetera. So I find NPR rather rah-rah in most cases about the current policy, I'm afraid, and just arguing about the details of the strategy more than any kind of broader critique. Globalization, an idea that globalization from above is just another euphemism for an imperial sort of system, I thought you might be sympathetic to, but I'm not sure now. But those are some of the points I just picked up while I was waiting to get on. I wanted to start by saying that it's curious that the World Series, if I'm right, is the name comes from it being initially sponsored by the Daily World.
Right.
So there weren't any pretensions that it was really any kind of global thing, but the position of the U.S. in the world is such that it has. So it seems to me a curious capturing of some of the so-called globalization of the world. I wanted to also maybe see whether you speak much about the finance involved and whether the gaming of the sports world also includes, you know, I assume there probably are different derivatives. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of illegal gambling in many venues, but I wonder whether the corporate world is also applying their derivatives to sports. And the other part of the financing business is this the way what should be going towards spending on human needs is actually being spent on stadium construction. We have the example of the Rangers going bankrupt after it was one of the step-ups that George W. Bush had, where the value of the team increased exponentially when there was a new stadium built by government largesse. So I know I'm throwing out a whole lot of tendrils there, but perhaps on this Monday morning you could weave some of that together.
All right. Well, let's see what we can do.
Well, there's lots, obviously, tons of stuff here. World Series, the world, absolutely. Although, sure, that's true. Although, of course, the very fact that all American champions call themselves world champions does in fact bespeak a certain kind of isolation and also a certain form of kind of hubris, if you will. So even though you write about the World Series, Daily World, although that some baseball historians dispute that, but still, I totally agree with you with that. It was the first. Still, it's odd that the champion of the NBA and the Super Bowl calls itself, even though they might in fact be very much the best in the world. I'm sure they are. Call themselves world champions. No other country does that. But just very briefly, and then if Lars wants to come in on this also, we don't talk about gambling. There's a great book on that, the title of which we're citing the book. It escapes me. But what we do argue, however, is that the financial dimensions that are so always kind of touted and always mentioned about sports are actually peanuts. Just recently, Lars and I did a little research, and we looked at, Manchester United by Forbes last week is the most expensive, most highest, greatest team of market capitalization with $1.8 billion, followed by the Yankees, the Dallas Cowboys. We mentioned this in the book. We give some other data, and actually now in the meantime, we've actually supplemented this. There's 32 companies in Michigan alone that are bigger than this, and by a long shot. So the point is that sports, the power of Manchester United and the New York Yankees has very little to do with money. It's all about cultural capital. It's about attachment. It's about identity. $2 billion, it's a mid-link to small company in New York, even in Michigan.
Yeah, Andy already said it. That's really a big point to make. People very often misperceive the money that's involved and the economic and overstate and exaggerate the economic aspect of sports. It really is about culture much more than anything. It's much more about identity. It's much more about cultural capital. And just to add to this, when we look at the globalization here, we really, of course, there are corporate interests involved. Of course, there's advertisement involved. Of course, that is a part of sports, of professional sports. That's why it's professional sports in the 21st century. But we do look to respond to your question. We do look at globalization as a kind of globalization from below in the sports world as well. This is not just fabricated by some corporate interests or by franchises selling their products. It really is responding to a very strong and not just fabricated cultural demand and interest that has evolved over the longest time, and it is very much part of our quotidian culture of our daily lives, and at least for Andy and I, it's pretty much unthinkable to live without sports. And it certainly is, again, a part of that develops very much from below, from the bottom up, so to speak.
Hmm. I would just I certainly take the caller's point about the World Series and about the fact that in the professional World Series, it's the United States and Canada. That's the world. But I guess I'm also thinking about how this is a little bit different, but how on the level of youth sport that it becomes more international. And that, for example, if you look at who won the winners of the Little League World Series,
right.
Yes, the United States has dominated, but next to the United States, the country that has won the most has been Taiwan.
Right.
And also there have been significant numbers of world champions, Little League world champions from Japan, from Mexico. South Korea's won a couple of times. Venezuela's won a couple of times. So on that level, it truly does become something more international.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's amazing how diverse really this has become. And that even on the level of national teams, when you look at the World Cup in sports, you have teams that look very different 20 years ago. Now we have players like the Boateng brothers. One of them plays for Ghana, the other one for Germany. So it becomes a very different matter when it's very much meritocratic, and sports in that sense has changed a lot, and it influences society in a positive way in this sense, I'd say.
And I have several callers here, but I do it just real quick if I can. I want to ask you about soccer in the United States, which is a huge youth sport in the United States, and certainly there are Americans who follow it, and particularly now I think as the Latino population of the United States gets bigger, that means that there are going to be more soccer fans. All that having been said, and we've demonstrated the fact that we can certainly compete on the world level, all that having been said, why isn't soccer a bigger, professional soccer isn't bigger in the United States?
I'm laughing because this is the subject of an earlier book I wrote called Offside, also with Princeton University Press in 2001, and has become sort of a mini classic, Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism. We really don't have time to elaborate on this, but suffice it to say that, and again, we do a little bit in this book, although much less, but in this book we develop how the United States basically built its own sports languages. It is the only one with 3.5 or 4, as you already mentioned, hockey being one, but not quite. It's not as big in Illinois where you are as it is where Lars and I live,
sure.
Where we live near a town that proudly calls itself Hockey Town, not Baseball Town or Basketball Town, but Hockey Town. We'll talk about Detroit. So the long story is, short thing of the long story is that basically, while the rest of the world, meaning in this case Britain or England, the continental Europe and Latin America, not much of the rest of the world, but these, while they developed the association game, shortened in British slang, by the way, to the word soccer. Soccer is not an American term. It's a British term. It's a British student slang term, as English as it can be, they called this game, the association game, short sock for soccer, while it developed into this major culture encompassing all aspects of sports society and culture. The United States developed its own version of another football, which became American football, and having also developed these other sports that became hegemonic. Soccer always existed in the United States from the 1880s on. It never disappeared, but it remained marginal. It was something that people did rather than followed. And this began to change with the NASL in the 1960s and 70s, and then with the soccer boom, as you correctly point out, where millions play it. But the big question that still is with us is how many will follow it. I just literally 2 minutes before you called me, I got a very sad note from a friend who traveled to Oneonta to visit the United States Soccer Hall of Fame, and he emailed me back. I unfortunately knew this, that, of course, it's closed a year ago for lack of interest. So what we're arguing in the book, and I think one of the major points about the book so emphatically, is that soccer is what we call an Olympianized culture in America. If you look at what the World Cup did a couple of weeks ago, it was unbelievable. The U.S.-Algeria game and the Ghana-U.S. game, one of them was on a weekday in the middle of the workday, the other one early on Saturday, had achieved major figures, 6 million, 8 million viewers. The final was as high as an NBA final. However, do people now follow the New England Revolution playing the Columbus Crew? Unclear or very unlikely. So in other words, what we have now, and that's relatively new, starting basically with 1994, that the U.S., again, because of the second globalization. Now, if you're a kid in the United States and you want to follow soccer with the with ESPN, with Fox Soccer Channel, with the Internet, you can follow any of your preferred teams in the world. Lars, he's a big Roma fan, has repeatedly seen students walking around the Michigan campus with a Roma jersey. This was unthinkable 5 years ago, certainly 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, what has happened is that soccer has entered the American sports space, but it's still on some level quite marginal beyond the mega events of the World Cup, the mega events coming of Manchester United playing the MLS All-Stars. Last week in Houston, it was the fourth most watched All-Star game of any kind. There were 77,000 people there. Think about that. But, of course, that's Manchester United coming to play on a particular day. Will it ever become a part of the American sports vernacular? We don't know. I worry that it won't happen in my lifetime as a huge soccer fan. Maybe in Lars's lifetime. He's a tad younger than I am. But that's a different – we don't know that. And that's also not our job to predict. What we do know is that it has undergone a tremendous change in its texture. Again, when I came in 1960, no one knew about this. Zero. Nothing. Other than Hungarian immigrants in New York and their various – you played in a particularly obscure league. Today, it's a known entity.
Well, let's talk with some more people who are listening here. We have a couple of people. We'll take them in the order they came in. We have a couple to start out with in Urbana. So we'll do Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
This is a very interesting subject. Does your book discuss sports as it's practiced now and the scale it is? Do people use, I mean, it's a psychological term, do they use it as a substitution for something? Like when you watch a football game, if you go to the game or you watch it on TV, and there's a lot of actual violence on the field. And if you watch soccer, you see people, cutting each other off and things like that. I wonder if people, if culture sort of, this sort of built up as an outlet for people's tendencies to sort of a relief when they watch it, like they can watch someone else do something sort of violence but not killing and sort of relieve themselves. Does your book discuss that, or do you have an opinion on that?
No, actually, this will be the shortest answer. We do not discuss that at all. And both of us being sort of macro-oriented social scientists, we do not get into this. And, maybe Lars wants to supplement this, but the answer is very simply no.
I would like to supplement it in one respect only. We don't get into the psychology aspect very much, that's for sure. But there's one thing that is important, I think, that under certain conditions, sports can actually not just function as an outlet or to some extent a regulated outlet rather than, some unregulated violence, or and that is when you look at, I'll just give you one example, under certain conditions, when you look at, compare the cities of Glasgow and Belfast, and look at that, the fact that in Glasgow, sure, there's still old hostilities between Catholics and Protestants. It's not actually much of a religious thing anymore. It's has very much become ritualized. And but in many ways, this kind of ritualization that takes place, we can see acted out in the stadium. You root for one or the other team. You root for Celtics or Rangers. And but after that, you go home, basically, and that's that. Whereas in places, again, under certain conditions that need to be met, in places where you don't have that culture, that sports culture, there is the point being, sports can function as a pacifying medium. It can pacify conflicts. I do believe in that. We just touched on this a little bit, and of course, those long old conflicts can change and be transformed through sports culture. We have one thing in our book that illustrates that a little bit. Someone asked an apparently Muslim woman in the city of Glasgow, what are you? And she answers, a little baffled, don't you see that? I'm a Muslim. And then the Glasgowegian says, of course I can see that, but are you a Celtic Muslim or are you a Rangers Muslim? And so this is a little twist to the understanding that sports or these local identities are just reinforcing animosities that actually can change things. And in many ways, this outlet, if you will, can ritualize conflicts in a way that might pacify conflicts and transform them to become a little less violent.
I appreciate the comment of the Carl. Let's go on to another Urbana person, line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi, yes. I'm calling from Urbana. I actually live in Washington, D.C., but I'm just visiting. And I teach there a course on globalization to high school students who were very obsessed with the World Cup, as you just described, and not just the U.S. games, all the different countries. And your book sounds fascinating. And my question, though, is actually about women and sports and whether or not your research touched on that. Obviously, the status of women, you know, varies worldwide, and women professional sports isn't even that big in the United States. But I'm curious to see whether or not your research touched upon women's sports at all.
Yes, we're very proud to that it certainly does. We devote an entire chapter to women's sports, especially women's soccer. We're all even more thrilled that our book, its first, is the legendary Brandi Chastain, whom you, I'm sure you will know as the one of the great American soccer players. Yes, I apart now from Lars, am pursuing this massively, namely in the context of how, and by the way, women and soccer in the United States are unique. Again, I don't have time to elaborate this. But what is so interesting is that women in the course of the last 20 to 30 years have become almost equal on the side of working, of playing. In other words, on the production side, especially through Title IX, women have blossomed in the world of sports. Yet on the following side, in other words, what do they follow? How do they talk about sports? How does it impact on their lives? It's still very different. Moreover, as I'm now looking at a new aspect, it's the last realm of what I call separate but equal, meaning that even with Title IX, all we want is actually for women to have their own teams and have their own sports. But it's, in fact, the last vestige. The Olympics, everywhere in sports, we have a complete gender segregation. And the question, of course, is why is that the case? But we don't have time for me to elaborate on this, but it's a wonderful question you should discuss with your high school students. Mm.
Another thing that just very quickly I think is really interesting that you also write about is that in those places where soccer really hasn't been that big traditionally, women's soccer has really caught on, much more so than for the men, whereas in places where they've always played soccer, the idea of women playing the game isn't quite as acceptable.
Right. It's basically the women in the United States were allowed, quote-unquote, were allowed to blossom in the game that the men just didn't care about. Okay, so in fact, they had this wonderful opportunity, again, driven very much by Title IX and the enlightened legislation that asked that or demanded colleges to have as many female scholarships for female athletes as for male, which of course immediately gave soccer a wonderful option because it's a large team sport to counterweigh the heaviness of American football with its 85 scholarships, that in fact it gave it a space where the United States has become the best female sports soccer team in the world, having won at least some form of medal at every major tournament since 1991.
We have about a minute. I want to see if you can at least do that on an email question I got here, because I think it's interesting. Someone would like to know, you know, what in Europe, what are they trying to do? How are they trying to address racism and anti-Semitic fan behavior in professional football?
Well, what we show in this book is that it varies a lot. So it really depends on the league. It really depends on the country. There are our fan initiatives coming from below. There is a varying degree of willingness of sports authorities and political authorities to do something about this, to address this problem, and we can see these effects. In those cases where this willingness has still not emerged, where there's no strong consensus that this needs to be addressed, we have much more problems. We show that in our book, than those countries where, in many ways belated, this problem has been addressed and been taken more seriously by creating laws, by making sure law enforcement is functional, but also by reaching out on the club level to the fan scenes and cooperating with anti-racist fan initiatives.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of the time. There's much more we could talk about. What I'm just going to have to say is, if you want to read more on the subject, look for the book Gaming the World by our guests, Andre Markowitz and Lars Rensman. Andre Markowitz is a professor of comparative politics and German studies at University of Michigan. Professor Markowitz, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Lars Rensman, assistant professor of political science, also at Michigan. Professor Rensman, thank you.
Thanks, David. Thanks a lot.